And hello, Sons House listeners. This is Andy Bombeck, which means once again, it's time for the Children's Story Hour. And as always, I'm glad you can join me today for a good variety of children's stories. Like always, the first half hour, I'll be reading picture books. And then the second half hour, I'm going to continue with the novel that I've been reading now for a couple months, titled The Ballad of Darcy and Russell. But first, let's begin today's program with the picture book titles. I'm going to start off with a book titled Box of Dreams. And then it's Circle of Love, Mr. Walker Steps Out, Bound to Dream, An Immigrant Story. And if we have time, I'll finish up the first half hour with Nice Try, Charlie. So it should be a lot of fun. Let's get started with our first picture book today, titled Box of Dreams. Mama was packing up a big box to send to the Philippines. Is this for someone's birthday, I ask? Mama replied, no, Anik, it's a Balisbanyan box. It means return to home, and it's how we share our blessings with our family. This box makes me feel closer to them, even though we're so far away. I see a treasure trove of Palsongbong, ranging from gifts and treats to everyday items and hand-me-downs. We packed jeans and t-shirts for the older cousins and, for the younger ones, some brand new school supplies. The yellow pencils remind Mama of her school days in the Philippines. I was in charge of getting my younger brother and sisters ready in the morning. Then we would meet our cousins on the way to school and trade tales of the great Mayan volcano while skipping around the rice paddies. Sweet mangoes hung from the trees, just perfect for our snack on the way home. I wish my walk to school was this much fun. Did they have a pool? I asked Mama. No, but they do have beautiful beaches lined with coconut trees and catamarans. We would splash around in the Pacific, sharing peely nut candy and calamansi juice under the sun. Looking around at everything for the box, I wondered what could I share. I ran to my room to look. I'll add my gold star shirt for good luck, my rainbow ruler for good measure, and my pink sparkly jacket for a little glam. I'm sure my cousins will love these. Mama included bags of rice flour for Lola's famous bibigingka. When I was growing up, your Lola made the best rice cakes in clay pots for all the family parties and holidays. The sweet scent of Lola's bibigingka was calling. Maybe one day I can try it too. The box is filled with such special gifts. Mama, why are you sending toothpaste? I ask. Mama said they really like this kind and it's hard to find there. I wondered what kind they do have. As we close up the box, I sneak in a little something, too. It's a wish to travel with the box and fly to the Philippines so I can meet all of my relatives there. I'd go from the big city of Manila, skyscrapers and all, to Mama's home in the province near the majestic volcano with its perfect cone shape. I dream of dipping my toes in the warm tropical waters, tasting sweet and crunchy peely nut candy, and sipping on the delicious tart calamansi juice, just like Mama once did. Along my journey, I'd see boxes connecting families across oceans and lands. Boxes of dreams with different languages and flavors, filled with Pasalabong, hope, and love, returning home to where the heart is. My secret wish is carefully tucked in, until one day when Mama and I return home and everyone is together again. Because this is no ordinary box. Circle of Love. And here's the foreword. We welcome someone into our home or space in Nihawetwin by saying Pawa. The beauty of this word is that it means so much more than a simple welcome. On a deeper level, it means there is always room. In many ways, this is what Molly is sharing with us in this story as she introduces us to the people she loves. She reminds us that there is always room in our hearts and in the circles of our lives. The circle is a place of equality and equity and ultimately love. Tonight, we are gathering at the Intertribal Community Center for a feast. When my friends and elders greet us, I feel joyful. When Kolkum and her wife, Kolkum Raven, sing a welcome song, I feel connected. Love is love. When my teacher says, Tensi Molly, I feel important. When I read books to the babies, I feel kind. When my uncles and I play peekaboo with their baby, I feel love. Love is love. When I draw pictures with my friend Sophie, I feel creative. When my sibling plays their music, I feel energized. When they teach us jingle dance steps, I feel motivated. Love is love. When my cousins take us outside to the playground, I feel excited. When the wind blows in my hair and the sun warms my face, I feel powerful. When I see Sarah and Carolina tend the community garden, I feel appreciative. Love is love. When I smell the sweet grass burning, I feel peace. When I watch my parents prepare for ceremony, I feel respect. When I help make the food offering, I feel honored. Love is love. When a prayer is said to bless the food, I feel thankful. When I eat my soup and banak, I feel nourished. When my friend Billy and his moms sing to give thanks for dinner, I feel happy. Love is love. When my auntie speaks to me in Nahuainin, I feel proud. When I sip my medicine tea, I feel the warmth swirl down my throat. When I watch Joshua bead, I feel awe. Love is love. When I curl up under Kolkum Raven's arm, I feel safe. When I close my eyes, I can see the stories that are being told. When my family and community come together, I feel love. Love is love. Mr. Walker steps out. Mr. Walker worked very hard. Every day he stood in the window of his boxy little house on the corner of Broadway and Main and let people know when it was safe to cross the street. When it was not safe, he held up a big red hand so everyone would stop and wait. As he worked, Mr. Walker watched lots of wonderful things happening just beyond his window. He saw puddles being splashed and bikes being ridden, kids licking towers of ice cream, and dogs tugging owners on their leashes. Most days, watching was more than enough. But sometimes Mr. Walker wished he could step out of his boxy little house and do something wonderful himself. So, one day, he did. Mr. Walker propped up the big red hand in the window of his boxy little house and jumped down to the sidewalk below. Leaving was easy. He wondered why he'd never done it before. When it was safe to cross the street, Mr. Walker crossed, and right away he started doing wonderful things. Buying an ice cream cone, walking a dog. With each new thing he tried, Mr. Walker felt just a little bit bigger than he'd been the day before. It was a very nice feeling. So Mr. Walker hopped on a bus downtown where he could do even more wonderful things, things he had never dreamed of doing. Some things were silly, like climbing in a little airplane. Some were strange, like taking hot air balloons up to a high rise. Some were scary, like skateboarding on a ramp. Some were downright magical, like looking at New York City from Brooklyn Bridge. With each day that passed, Mr. Walker found more wonderful things to do, like ride the cyclone at Coney Island. Still, every once in a while, Mr. Walker would find himself thinking about his home on the corner of Broadway and Main. He wondered about the puddles and the bikes and the kids and the dogs, and how they were all getting along without him. He wondered if they'd noticed he was gone. And he wondered, now that he felt so much bigger, if he'd still fit inside his boxy little house in quite the same way. And then, suddenly, something happened. Something very, very big. On the street in front of him, a truck's tires screeched, horns honked, cars swerved, dogs barked, people shouted. And in the middle of it all, someone stood frozen, someone very, very small. It was a little girl Mr. Walker saw who was trying to cross the street. Without thinking about whether he was doing something big or something small, Mr. Walker took the little girl's hand. And when it was safe to go, he helped her cross the street. That afternoon, Mr. Walker made his way back to the corner of Broadway and Main. He found that he'd missed his corner quite a bit. As it turned out, his corner had missed him too. When Mr. Walker climbed back into his boxy house, it didn't feel nearly as small as it had before. It seemed to have grown while he was gone, just the same as he had. Mr. Walker fit perfectly. He took down the red hand that he had propped up in the window, and he signaled to the people that it was safe to cross the street. From that day on, whenever Mr. Walker watched the big, wonderful world from the window of his not-so-little house, he felt proud, because he knew that he was an important part of it all. But even the most important people need vacations sometimes, and it shows him sitting on a beach reading a book. Bound to Dream, an Immigrant Story. Carlo lived on a farm at the edge of a forest in Italy. By day, he milked cows and chopped wood. At night, after his chores, he read books by candlelight. The warm smell of the leather book covers and the faint scent of the forest rose from the pages. The golden glow of candlelight filled his dreams with people in faraway places. One day, when he was old enough, Carlo sailed away on a steamship across the ocean to New York City. When he arrived at the port, he joined a long line of people waiting to enter America. Carlo walked the streets of the city for weeks looking for work. It was a sad and lonely time for him. He could not speak or read English very well, and he missed his home and his family. He felt lost in the big city where no one knew his name. One late afternoon, just before sunset, he stopped in front of a bookbinder shop and looked in the window. He couldn't believe his eyes. So many beautiful books, he whispered to himself. A kind old man came out of the shop and stood beside him. "Are you looking for work?" asked the man. Carlo was silent. The man looked closely at Carlo and noticed he was dressed in the clothes of an immigrant. The man repeated his question in Italian. "Stari cercando lavoro?" Carlo smiled up at the old man and said, "Si." Carlo soon learned the art of bookbinding. He learned how to tan leather for the handsome book covers. He learned how to hand-stitch the pages together to make the beautiful books he was learning to read in English. Every night he sat up in his bed, looking at the books by the glow of the fire, studying the words and the sentences, practicing his English out loud to himself. Word by word, page by page, he spent each night poring over his books until the fire went out. Carlo got up every morning and walked many blocks to the bookbinder shop. He loved his books. He loved to make them and hold them in his hands. And he loved how he could smell the forest coming through the pages. Carlo could almost feel the warmth of the cattle coming through the leather covers of his books. Carlo was a quiet man, but when he spoke, his words sounded like poetry. When he grew older and had a family of his own, he shared his story with them. "Carlo was my great-grandfather. My father told me this story. I never met my great-grandfather, but I am grateful for the love he put in his books. I am grateful for the love of books he put in me. And I am grateful for the love of books in you." Nice try, Charlie. Charlie finds things. And he finds things to do with the things that he finds. Sometimes he finds it harder than he'd like to admit, but he tries. There really is an amazing amount of garbage lying around. It is even up in the trees, and he's looking at a pair of boots. And so is Aunt Myrtle's cat. Charlie gets him down, being careful not to get scratched. And then Charlie notices his friend Steve sitting on the stairs. Thank you," he says, holding his cat. "Hi, Steve." But Steve only sighs. Steve has a lot on his mind. Also, he is pie-eyed. And by that, I mean he eyes a pie. Aunt Myrtle spots it too. "Look," she yells out the window. "What is it?" Aunt Myrtle yells. "It's a huge tart," Charlie says. In fact, it is a pie. Charlie's heart stirs. "We should eat this right now," he proclaims, not believing his good fortune. "Not so fast," Aunt Myrtle yells. Aunt Myrtle always yells. Charlie looks up at her with raised eyebrows. Aunt Myrtle looks down and yells again, "Does that pie belong to you?" And so Charlie closes up the box and sets off to find the owner. "Nice try, Charlie," this girl yells from inside a fence. Margaret's ball has gone over the fence. Charlie tries to throw it back to her. Then he tries again, and he tries again after that. "By the way, are you missing a pie?" "Nope." And then Margaret goes and gets the ball herself. Over by the park, Charlie can hear an awful racket. Malcolm is playing his tuba. Charlie can imagine that it is supposed to sound this way, but Malcolm doesn't want any of Charlie's help. Also, it isn't Malcolm's pie. A little while later, Charlie happens upon a tire. "This tire is for the birds," he's picking it up. The birds are tired, and it isn't their pie either. He fills up the tire with water for a bird bath. No one Charlie talks to is missing a pie, it seems. Charlie walks back to where Steve was sitting. Steve sits there still. "Are you okay?" Charlie asks him. "I don't know," says Steve. They are both feeling kind of sad. "Yeah," says Charlie, "it's hard to know." Steve hands Charlie his binoculars and suggests he look through them backwards. It makes everything smaller, but Charlie still feels more or less the same. And they are both getting hungry, and so is this dog. Meanwhile, Aunt Myrtle knows just what to do. She gets into her elevator, rides it down, and calls everyone together. Aunt Myrtle sets out little plates and knives and forks for everybody, and they are extremely polite when she asks them who would like some pie. "Yes, please," they all say. Charlie finds things, and he finds things to do with the things that he finds. But he never did find out whose pie it was, but at least he tried. No matter what, a foster care tale. One day, Grace was soaring over the river when she spotted a young squirrel crying. Grace glided down. "What are you doing out here all alone?" "Josh," she asked. "Let's find you a family, shall we?" She started with the pelicans. They smelled too fishy. Then to the porcupines. They felt too prickly. Next to the kangaroos. They were too hoppy. "He's a squirrel," said Mr. Kangaroo. "He needs to learn about trees and climbing." So Grace swooshed him over to the leopards. At night, the leopards would go looking for food in the dark. Josh was afraid of the dark. "Ha, ha, look, he's a scaredy cat," taunted one young leopard. "More like a scaredy squirrel," said another. "Nobody is ever going to want me," Josh thought. When it was time to go to bed, Josh followed the leopards up their tree. But on the way, he spotted a small squirrel-sized hole, a place he could be alone. Right then and there, he decided, "I'll crack them before they crack me." When the leopards woke up, they were furious. "Who ruined our coats?" "Who?" they roared. "Oh, that? It was just playing a little game of connect the dots," Josh said. "That's it. I'm sorry, but you cannot live here," Mrs. Leopard said. 5 days to crack the leopards. Josh was determined to spend even less time with the next family. Grace took Josh from the bats to the monkeys and from the otters to the snakes. Josh tried to break his record of 5 days, but it didn't make him feel any better. Grace knew about the trouble Josh was causing, and she had an idea. "Josh," she said, "I have just the family for you." "Not interested," said Josh, and with that, Grace picked him up and flew toward the Great Falls. "Josh, this is Rodney and Christine Elephant," Grace said, "and this is Josh." "Nice to meet you, Josh," Rodney said. He stuck out his trunk. "Weird. Am I shaking your hand or your nose?" Josh asked. "Both," chuckled Rodney. "Oh, hey, What do you get when an elephant sneezes? You get out of the way. Lame, Josh said, trying to hide his laughter. Before Grace left, she turned to Josh. Please, give them a chance. So, he tied their tails in a knot and put flamingos in their front yard and brought a skunk inside their house. But elephants are very large and very patient. Say hello to my little friend, and Josh is holding up a skunk. Every night when they tuck Josh in, they would say, good night, Josh. We're glad you're here with us today. And we're glad you'll be here with us tomorrow. Tomorrow. That was the part that messed up Josh's plan. Luckily, Josh had an idea he knew would break through their tough hide and crack them. The next morning, Josh went to the clearing near the river. It was time for Operation Crash. This will make them get rid of me for sure. But Rhino was way faster than Josh thought. Josh was not a good swimmer. Worst of all, the river was rushing toward the Great Falls. It's Josh, cried Christine. Everyone to the river, bellowed Rodney. We have to get him before he goes over the falls. The river rushed and gushed around Rodney, but his massive legs were anchored firmly as the lifeline of animals held strong. Rodney pulled Josh from the river and lifted him toward Christine. Josh didn't know what to say. Do you know what squirrels and elephants have in common? Asked Rodney. What? Asked Josh. We both have excellent memories, Rodney said. So here's something I want you to remember. No matter what you do, we love you, and we're not going anywhere. At that moment, Josh knew that someone would always be there for him, no matter what, a real family. Oh, hey, Josh said, what do you get when you cross an elephant with a potato? Mashed potatoes. Rodney laughed. Speaking of potatoes, let's go home and have dinner. Dinner sounded good to Josh, too, but home sounded the very best of all. And this book is dedicated to my foster parents, Rodney and Christine Wiedemeyer, the strong, immovable, and loving family that pulled me out of my rushing river. And I'm going to finish up the first half hour of today's program with a picture book titled Owen's Day with Daddy. Owen's daddy was holding the baby. He made sounds for the baby with his tongue. Cluck, cluck. He smiled at the baby. He said, how you doing, little man? He kissed the baby right on the head. Owen stomped his foot and yelled, I want to do something with you, Daddy. The baby started to cry. My tummy feels sick, Owen said, when everything was calm again. I'm sorry to hear that, said Daddy. Do you still want to do something? Like what? Said Owen. Then he had an idea. Not one thing, three things. Okay, said Daddy, three things. What's the first thing? Owen thought about it. The park. At the park, the ducks swam in the pond. Duck, duck, hungry duck, Daddy called. Duck, duck, hungry duck, Owen called. Duck, duck, hungry duck. Daddy took the bag of dried corn from his pocket. He poured some corn into Owen's hand. Lunchtime, munchtime, Daddy called. He tossed some corn on the grass. Lunchtime, munchtime, Owen called, and he tossed some corn on the grass, too. A mama duck and six baby ducks waddled over. They gobbled up the corn. You feed the babies, Daddy said. He poured more corn into Owen's hand. I'll feed the mama. Owen sprinkled corn by his feet. The babies came right up and ate it. He put a piece of corn on the toe of his shoe. One of the babies snatched it. He put a piece of corn in the middle of his hand and held it out. A baby duck ate it. I ate the corn on my hand. It ate the corn on my hand, Owen shouted. It likes you, said Daddy. When the corn was gone, Daddy crunched up the bag. What's next? He asked Owen. Owen thought about it. The playground. The playground had two slides, a big slide and a little slide. Which slide today? Daddy asked. Owen thought about it. The ladder on the big slide went up and up. One time, Owen had started climbing, but it was too high. He began to cry, and his daddy carried him down. That one, said Owen, pointing to the little slide. Then he thought some more. No, that one, he said, pointing to the big slide this time. Owen stood by the ladder. He looked up. His head felt funny. His tummy felt funny. He touched the ladder. It was cold. I'll be right behind you, Daddy said. Together, Owen and his daddy climbed the ladder. At the top, Daddy said, you can sit on my lap. When they were ready, Daddy said, let's count. 1, 2, 3. Down they went. Owen screamed. His daddy screamed. When their feet touched the ground, Owen shouted, again. Whee! After 3 more times, Daddy said, it's almost lunchtime. What's next, Owen? Owen thought about it. Cheeseburgers. At the drive-thru, Daddy asked, you want to give the order, Owen? 3 cheeseburgers and 3 French fries, Owen said out the car window. Don't forget milkshakes, Daddy whispered, and 3 milkshakes. On the drive home, Owen asked, can babies drink milkshakes? No, they aren't big enough yet, Daddy said. I am, said Owen. At home, Mama sat in the rocking chair. She was feeding the baby. I gave the baby ducks corn, Owen said, and I went down the big slide. Wow, said Mama, you're growing up, Owen. I ordered cheeseburgers too, Owen said, holding up the bag, and milkshakes. And the baby is too little for milkshakes, he added. Owen put the plates on the table, 3 plates. I think it's time for the baby's nap, Mama said. Can I kiss him first? Owen asked. Of course, said Mama. Owen kissed the baby so softly on top of his head. 3 kisses. The baby didn't wake up, and Owen felt very grown up indeed. And this is just a reminder. My name is Andy Bombeck, and I hope you're enjoying the Children's Story Hour. And as I mentioned at the beginning of today's program, for the second half hour, I'm going to continue reading the novel that I've been reading now for a couple months, titled The Ballad of Darcy and Russell. Darcy believes in love at first sight. She spent her whole life waiting for that perfect, magical moment. But right now, her life is anything but perfect. After a music festival, she's stranded at a bus station until morning, the day before she leaves for college. Her phone is dead, she has no cash, and she's convinced nothing good can come of this night. But then she meets Russell. Russell, cute and nice, funny and kind. This is the moment and the guy she's been waiting for. And they have until sunrise to walk and talk and connect. Over the course of this one fateful night, filled with football field picnics, night swimming, and escape artist dogs, Darcy and Russell's lives will change forever. They'll discover things they never imagined about each other and about themselves. But can you really know someone after only a handful of hours? Is it possible to fall in love in just one day? And is it worth saying hello when you know you're destined for a goodbye? Okay, last week at the taco truck, Darcy told Russell that she's leaving tomorrow to start college in Connecticut. Darcy also finds out that Russell has with him and is reading her favorite book of all time called Theseus's Sailboat, about two people who meet and fall in love. And that's where I left off last week. Russell was still staring at me, and I realized I probably hadn't been clear at all. Sorry, it's a novel, I explained as he knelt down by the backpack at his feet and started digging through it. It's actually my favorite novel. He stood up, and I saw he was holding something in his hand, a battered hard copy of Theus's Sailboat. Oh my God! What? I took his copy from him, just staring at it. It was a different edition from mine. His cover showed a couple looking out at the water, a cat winding around their feet, a whale breaching in the background. This was the book. I realized he was reading when I'd first seen him across the bus station. How is it your favorite book? He asked. It's my favorite book, and nobody's ever heard of it. I know it's a tragedy. I keep trying to get my friends to read it, and nobody ever will. I did get Tall Ben to start it, at least. He couldn't get through the camp stuff. Yeah, that part can be tough. But if you just make it through, I know, he's missing out. We just looked at each other for a moment. What was this? How was this happening? Even in all my daydreams about what it would be like when I fell for someone, I hadn't allowed myself to imagine something this wonderful. Someone this cute, this easy to talk to, who just got me and loved the same book I did. It was like opening up the most beautifully wrapped present under the tree and finding a kitten inside. A level of wonderful I hadn't even known to ask for. This is crazy, Russell said. He took a tiny step toward me. I looked up at him, my pulse galloping, his favorite book in my arms, and my eyes locked on his. I took a step toward him. Everything in me was screaming for me to kiss him, or at least take his hand again and... Ready? The woman behind the table yelled. We both turned to her as she set a big paper bag with our order on the table. Drinks? She didn't have Sidril Mundet, so I got a Sprite and Russell got a pineapple Jarritos. He handed over his 20 to pay, and as she counted out his change, I noticed a little cardboard box on the table, selling candy for the Jesse High Teacher Supply Fund. They were bags of Skittles and Hershey bars, but then also less familiar candy, Big Cherry and Abba Zaba. Want anything? Russell asked. He picked up the Abba Zaba and turned it over in his hands. Oh man, I haven't had one of these in years. I'm not sure I ever have, I said, as the woman set Russell's change down on the table. He bought the Abba Zaba too and dropped the rest of the change in her tip jar. I started to walk away, figuring we'd be sitting on the parking blocks to eat, like those women, when something occurred to me. I turned back and nodded at the candy box. This high school, I said, where is it? Chapter 5, Sunday, 6:30 p.m. This was an excellent idea, Russell said as he looked over at me from where we were sitting across from each other, sprawled in the very center of the football field. It hadn't been very far to Jesse High, just a few blocks over from the parking lot. I thought that maybe we could eat on the benches by the front entrance, but then I'd seen the goalpost and had a better idea. The football field was astroturf, and the white lines of the gridiron spray painted on. It wasn't a stadium or anything, just the field and some bleachers set up on either side. And right now, we had it all to ourselves. Why, thank you, I said. I'm glad it's not offensive. Russell groaned, but in a way that seemed appreciative. I set the bag down between us and opened it up, unpacking our dinner and spreading out our football field picnic. There were lights at all four corners of the field, turned off at the moment. It wasn't dark out yet, but the sun was thinking about setting. The moon was already rising, and a neon sign I could see beyond the football field was just beginning to glow. So even though the light was fading, I could still see everything I needed to. are tacos, the scoreboard, Russell's face. "What do you think happened there?" I asked, nodding toward the scoreboard. It was an older kind of non-electric. Right now, the score was home 69 and visitor 0. Russell looked at it and then laughed. I think some kids were having fun. A second later, I got it and felt myself blush. "Oh, right. Anyway, thanks again for dinner. I will pay you back." "Well, there's really no need. I was happy to do it." "Wow, you're missing an opportunity here. You could really hike up the prices." "Oh, you're unstoppable. I'm done now, I promise." "Not on my account. I'm impressed. You must have loved the chapter with all the rejected names for the bakery." "Yes." I unwrapped the foil around my taco. "That's one of my favorite sections." We'd done this on the whole walk over to the high school, talked about Theus's sailboat, our favorite chapters, our favorite lines, our theories about the characters. Just finding anyone else who loved this pretty obscure book and getting to talk to them about it would have been miracle enough. But here, in the middle of nowhere, for this boy to pull it from his bag like a magic trick, it meant something. It had to. I breathed in the taco aroma for just a moment before taking a bite. "Okay," I said, about a mouthful of carne asada. "That's good." "As good as Leo's? Not quite, but what is?" "So," Russell started. Then he bit into his own taco and his eyes widened. "Uh-huh. Okay. Yep." "Good, right?" "Excellent." I hadn't realized how hungry I was. I nodded and took another bite. It was better than anything I'd had at the festival, both food-wise and experience-wise. No, waiting. With crowds of people for overpriced, mediocre food that was going to eat alone. "Okay," I said as I took a paper napkin from the bag. Glad Russell had thought to grab a handful. "Explain to me your camp theory. You think the kids don't exist?" "Oh, they exist. They're just in a different timeline than the rest of the story. It's Will, when he was a kid. He's the camper everyone calls Billy, the last summer that the whales were there." "I don't know. Think about it. It's too random otherwise, right? And this way, the whole thing comes full circle." Russell stopped to take a breath and shook his head. "I just can't believe I have someone to talk about this with. I know, even if some of your theories are unsound." "Unsound?" I laughed as I lifted the top paper plate from my quesadilla, broke off one of the triangles, and offered it to him. "Want some?" "You sure?" "Of course. Thank you." He took the quesadilla triangle from me, our hands brushing again, sending another thrill all the way through me. "So, where do you fall with the whole Ship of Theus's thing?" Theus's sailboat was a reference to the thought puzzle of the Ship of Theus's, which I hadn't ever heard of before. I read the book, and I had a theory that the book would have done better if it had a different title. The puzzle describes a ship that's been rebuilt over the years, plank by plank, until none of the first ship remains. And the question was if that ship could still be considered the Ship of Theus's, even though none of the original components were there. "You mean, do I think it's still the same ship, even though every part of it has changed?" Russell nodded. I'd never had to think about it before, but then again, I'd never had anyone to talk about my favorite book with before. "I think so," I said slowly. "I mean, the essence still remains, right? It's more than the sum of its parts." "I think so, too. It's just like us, actually." "Wait," I held up my hands. "I think I sense a fun fact coming. A football field fun fact. Darcy. Friday night facts. Sunday night fact ball? I'm done now. Are you? Probably not. But I do want to know the fact. Well, it was just that we're like the ship too. Our whole systems change over every 7 years. So you're physically not the same person you were when you were a kid. But you're still you, right? I nodded, turning this over in my mind. It's actually why he stopped short and shook his head. Sorry, that was about to be an unfun fact. Well, now I have to hear it. Are you sure? Positive. So, Russell cleared his throat, it's where the phrase the seven-year itch comes from. Because back in the day, when you had scabies? I paused, a bite of quesadilla halfway in my mouth. Yeah, they're skin mites. And before people had antibiotics, they would have them for 7 years. I looked down at my quesadilla. I no longer had much of an appetite. I put it back on the plate and pushed it a little ways away from me. See? I told you it was unfun, not romantic at all. As soon as he said this, his eyes widened, like he just realized what he'd done. I smiled down at the astroturf. Now that he had said it out loud, it was just confirmation that we were on the same page, that maybe he liked me as much as I liked him. You don't actually know him, the Didi in my head piped up. She's getting to know him, Katie admonished her. Leave Darce alone. A breeze blew across the football field, not as warm as the one in the parking lot had been. It was definitely starting to get colder, and I reached for my canvas bag. I dug out my Nighthawks sweatshirt and pulled it on. Oh, Russell said as he looked at my sweatshirt, eyebrows raised. I looked down at it and laughed. I was used to it now, the image of Wiley Sanders, leather jacket open over his bare chest, staring soulfully at the camera. I would sometimes get double takes when I wore it out and about, but I didn't care. It almost became like a shibboleth. People I didn't even know would nod at me, and random strangers would smile and give me a thumbs up, like a secret code among Nighthawks fans. I know, it was my dad's. It's a lot. But fun, right? I guess you're a big fan, Russell was still blinking at Wiley, staring out at him. I mean, my dad is. He did name you after one of their songs. This is the truth. I suppose a casual fan wouldn't have done that. So, you're a fan too. I picked up my quesadilla again, thinking about it, as I took a bite. The Nighthawks had always just been the soundtrack in our home. I would know the second I stepped into the house or got into the car what kind of mood my dad was in based on which song was playing. He played me other stuff beside the Nighthawks, of course. We always had music on. Our system connected so that you could go from room to room and not lose a note. But the Nighthawks were his favorite, the thing he always came back to the most, his touchstone. I don't know, I said, slowly realizing I'd never had to put this into words before. They were basically the sound of my whole childhood, like I knew the songs before I remembered ever learning them. They were just part of me, the way you don't remember learning your name. He played you Nighthawk songs when you were a kid. I nodded, and Russell frowned. Even south of the border? I laughed, impressed that he could pull that one out. When it seemed like he hadn't even been familiar with Darcy, Wow, that's a deep cut. I just can't imagine playing it for a little kid. I don't think I even heard it until I was 13 or something. My dad didn't believe in the concept of kid music. He played me everything, so I learned these songs while having no idea what they were about. I sang Ecstasy Nights for a first grade talent show. Russell stared at me, taco forgotten, a smile tugging at the corner of his mouth. You did not. Yeah, my dad got called into a meeting with my teacher about it, but I think secretly he was proud. Russell laughed, but I actually don't know if I would have liked them if I'd just heard them on my own, you know? Like, the Nighthawks are my dad. Do I love them because of the music, or because I love my dad and he loves them? I shook my head and ran my hand over the fake grass. I'll never know, I guess. I can see that. Did you see their set? I flashed back to it, the way that when Wiley Sanders had run out on stage, everything that had gone wrong with Romy and the festival had melted away. I'd heard the first notes of Saturday Night Falls and been transported. Just the beginning. Oh, man, you missed out. It was great. He's so fantastic. And to just be there with all those other people. And he played Darcy, which he usually doesn't do in concert anymore. And there was a moment in Fair Weather where he held the mic out to the crowd and we all sang the chorus and I shook my head, the words spilling out fast. And I know this isn't an original thought at all, but at one point I looked around. At this moment, we were all experiencing this magic that was happening for just the people right then. And you could listen to a recording of it, but the experience was only if you were there. The one we were all sharing. I stopped and took a breath, knowing that I wasn't even getting close to capturing how it had felt. Russell smiled at me in the slowly falling darkness. Wow, that sounds really amazing. It's too bad your dad couldn't see it. Oh, I recorded the whole thing for him, which is basically why my phone is dead. Well, he'll appreciate it when you get home, though. I hope so. He's practically Wiley's biggest fan. I paused, considering of the music, at any rate. What do you mean? Oh, you know. Russell just shook his head. But even if he wasn't a huge fan, he had to know about Wiley Sanders' personal life. It was just out there, in the supermarket aisle, on the cover of People, fodder for late-night host, jokes, memes on social media, just how it's kind of a train wreck. He's been married a million times, and he has all these kids with different women, and his last wife was basically a teenager, right? And he and Candace Young are always in court. This was the most prominent of his breakups, mostly because it involved a movie star, someone as famous as him. They'd never gotten married, but had a son, and judging by the articles in Us Weekly, hadn't stopped fighting since. This was the only one of Wiley's kids who was in the press. The rest were pretty much out of public view, unless one of them behaved badly on social media. I seemed to remember a few years ago his daughter, was it Dakota, had been photographed skinny dipping off a yacht she'd borrowed without permission. Russell shrugged. I don't really know. Really? There was just a thing in Dietz Moy, he and his child bride fighting over custody of their twins. I reached for my bag to show him on my phone. Dead Amici, Russell reminded me. Right, that is hard to remember. You like Dietz Moy? There wasn't judgment in Russell's tone, exactly, more like surprise. I mean, it's not like I read it a lot, just for entertainment, you know. Russell nodded, his head bent, as he stuffed his trash in the paper bag. I was about to ask him if he ever read it, when I looked up and caught my breath, and what was happening in front of me drove away all thoughts of Instagram gossip sites. This was a glorious sunset streaked across the horizon. Apparently, while we'd been eating tacos, we'd missed the sky turning into a Van Gogh painting. Purple and pink and orange mixing together across the huge canvas of the desert sky. The mountains were silhouetted and huge, and the whole thing was just breathtaking. Needing to get a better view, I lay back, tipping my chin up, trying to take it all in. More than anything, I wanted to freeze this moment, so that when I needed to, I could call it back. The technicolor sunset and the astroturf under my bare legs, the faint breeze blowing, Russell's profile as he finished his Doritos, the feeling of pieces snapping at long last into place. Russell set his empty bottle down, then he lay back too and looked up. Wow! I know, I don't think I've ever seen one like this. We just lay there next to each other for a moment, looking up, the silence easy and comfortable between us. I turned my head to look at him. He was so close to me. I could have reached out and touched him without even having to extend my arm all the way. "Have you ever seen the Sistine Chapel?" Russell asked. "The what? In Italy?" "Yeah." "Well, not in person. I've seen pictures, though." "Well, when you go and see it, there are all these signs everywhere saying you're not allowed to lie down. Like in every different language, and with pictures and everything." "Okay." "So I was there with my family. We were all together, seeing it as a group with a guide. And after they'd told us all about it, the rest of my family started to leave. And I saw my moment." "You lay down?" "Well, I had to do it. I wanted to see it from that perspective, like Michelangelo would have." And unfortunately, this is where I'm going to have to stop today because we are out of time. I hope that everyone enjoyed today's program as much as I did. I want to say hi to all the listeners out there, and I want to encourage everyone to tune in next week when I continue with the novel, The Ballad of Darcy and Russell. Until then, I hope everyone has a great day and a fantastic week. So long and take care, everyone. Goodbye.